This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My name is Malini Singh. I don't know if I've met some of you from our last series, but I'm one of the co-chairs for this medical series called Medical Detectives with Dr. Jeff Tabus. I'm actually an emergency physician myself at SF General. And just got off shift, so excuse the lateness of this starting. In any case, so I'm also the medical director at the General, and I'm also an assistant clinical professor here at the UCSF School of Medicine. And we started off this series because we had recognized there's quite a bit of interest among the lay public about having a little bit of an insight into what we do. And so we put together this series, and what you'll notice is that it's a series of physicians from all different disciplines who come together and talk to you all about a little bit about the mystery of their distinctive discipline and how they sort of use their data gathering, the deductive reasoning to come to a diagnosis, to help manage a patient, and simply just to advance their own fields. So we find it very interesting that we have very enlightened physicians who are excited about what they do, find it still intriguing after many years of doing it, and want to share that with all of you. So that's one kind of a good reason for why this series, I think, is very interesting, because you sort of get the best of the lot. So without further ado, our first speaker of the series is Dr. Alan Wu. And I have to look down my notes because I got a 16-page CV from him. I had to condense it into one page. So I have to look down to reference the highlights, which is impossible. So Dr. Wu is actually the chief of clinical chemistry and toxicology at our hospital, SF General, and a professor of lab medicine at UCSF. He received his BS degree in chemistry and biology from Purdue University in Indiana. He then got a PhD in analytical chemistry from the University of Illinois. And then he actually finished a postdoc fellowship in clinical chemistry at Hartford Hospital in Connecticut. So clearly he moved to warmer climate. So good for you. It's a big plus. So Dr. Wu is actually certified by the American Board of Clinical Chemistry in both clinical chemistry and toxicological chemistry. Dr. Wu has a research interest in multiple areas, but he does actually have within the field of clinical chemistry at both the national and international level that include the development of biochemical markers that we use in disease processes like a heart attack or a stroke, which is especially interesting for us in the ED. He also has a long history of analytical and chemistry and clinical forensic toxicology background, so much so that he's actually a co-author of the National Academy of Clinical Biochemistry Lab Medicine Practice Guidelines. More recently, he's developed a research and clinical program in the area of pharmacogenomics. For those of us, including myself, who didn't know what that meant, basically it's a technology that analyzes your genetic makeup and how it'll affect your response to therapy. So quote-unquote personalized therapeutics, which is very interesting and very exciting. And actually, he's focusing a lot of his interest in the pharmacokinetics behind certain classes of drugs which are inclusive of tamoxifen, warfarin, like Coumadin, anti-seizure medications like Dilantin, and something that's also important for a lot of us, lipid-lowering drugs. So that's actually very interesting that he's involving his research in that topic. He's also lectured and published widely on both a national and international level, which took up most of the 16 pages for me to get through. He also has taught and mentored at all levels of students from high school all the way to postdoc fellows and has received a number of teaching awards from each of those groups. And actually just launched, for the layman public, two paperbacks. A month ago, launched a book called Toxicology, Because What You Don't Know Can Kill You. And these are stories that are based on real medical and forensic cases. I'm just going to do a little PR for him. It's right here. This was launched about a month ago. And it's actually available on the Kindle, too. So good beachside reading. And due out in March is another one of his books, which will be called The Hidden Assassin, When Clinical Lab Tests Go Awry. So without further ado, nothing gives us more excitement to hear about the medical mysteries behind a lot of the stuff that Dr. Wu does, and he's even written about it for all of us to read about it. So let's hear from Dr. Wu, who's here to talk to us about laboratory medicine.
Thank you, Melanie, and thank you all for spending an hour with us today. So I do have two copies of the book. I'm just going to pass them around. At the end of the lecture, I'm going to raffle them off. So I've got the names. I'm going to pick some names at random, and then you can take that home with you. I'll even sign it for you if you like. So, but it is available on Amazon, and it's something that I think you might enjoy reading. What I'm going to do today is actually talk about the real cases behind the stories that are in my book. Okay, so because of privacy laws, I've had to fictionalize the characters. I've embellished them, you know, a little bit like Hollywood. You know, you can't just tell the truth. You always have to make it a little bit more sexy or a little bit more intriguing. That's not going to be tonight. Tonight you're going to see the real cases. And then if you buy the book and you like the stories, you can think about what really happened. So, you know, I am not one of these great physicians. I'm not a physician. I'm a laboratory person. And people don't really know a lot about what we do. So I'm going to show you just a couple of slides of what we do and introduce that with this this little story here. I'm in this bar, and I see this attractive woman. And so I ask, well, what do you do for a living? Well, I do drug testing in a lab. Okay, and then the woman goes, oh, so are you some kind of narc? And he goes, no. I help patients who have been poisoned or overdosed. And then she goes, oh, excuse me, I have to powder my nose. Will you please excuse me? So, you know, we don't do these things to try to pick up women. It just, it sort of works the opposite way. So a lot of what I'm doing today, not just for you, but for other people, is to promote what we do in the laboratory. Why things that we do are important, not just for medical diagnoses and helping doctors like Dr. Singh, but there are things that I think that you need to know about because they can affect your daily life, and you need to be asking sometimes some of these questions. So this is the book that is available on Kindle. You see my website there as well. And then this is the book that is still in writing. I'm almost finished with it. So I have two editions. And what I'm going to do is tell you stories from both of these books. And you'll know which book it is because the cover will be on the book itself, on the stories itself. So I'm going to start off with a case that all of you know about and have all seen on TV. But maybe you don't know the behind the scenes. The story is called Slide Toxin. What's wrong with this picture? Of course, you know what this is. This is the Asiana plane crash that occurred back in July. Many of the patients who came to San Francisco General, I'm sure Dr. Singh had a lot to do with treating many of these patients. Does anybody see what's wrong with that picture other than the fact that, you know, the tail is missing? Okay, well, it's a little subtle. But if you look on this view, you'll see that there is a ladder at the door of the cockpit. Okay, so, you know, plane is crashed, there's going to be smoke, there's going to be fire. You have 90 seconds to get out of that plane if you have a chance of surviving. And if you're at the front and you can't go off the left side, you're not going to make it down the right side, okay, down a ladder? Are you kidding? So this was one of the airplane chutes, let's go back, that did not deploy. Okay, so this is what should have happened and did happen, except for this side. It malfunctioned. It didn't deploy. And what happened was, okay, so you can see that's a problem. Two of those evacuation chutes deployed inside the plane, and they trapped individuals underneath this big inflatable chute. You know, it's like a lifeboat in a closet. You know, it inflates and you're stuck behind it. And this is all what's going on when fire is about to break out. So one of the flight attendants saw that there are other people that were trapped underneath the chute, took a knife, cut open the chute, inflated it, and they were able to get out. Okay? But unfortunately, one of those people who was trapped underneath the chute ended up coming to our ICU and was very sick, and was sick for a long time, had a unexplained metabolic acidosis, survived the actual injury of the crash itself. But then the question came to us through the California Poison Center, could there have been another toxin that might have caused this delayed toxicological reaction? So we were asked to look into this. How do airplanes chutes deploy? Well, you just need to go back to your cars and you have your answer. It's the same thing that an airbag in an automobile explodes. It's actual chemical reaction. You can see it on the right there. Sodium azide is ignited, and then nitrogen gas quickly fills this airbag within just a few milliseconds. Now, if you can imagine that, okay, an airbag, you know, maybe 10 liters. Now we're talking about an airplane chute that might be 20 meters long and 3 meters thick. The amount of sodium azide present in that chute is actually quite alarming. And we know that sodium azide is very toxic. So could it be that these individuals who were trapped under the chute, on whom the bag was broken open, and they were exposed to sodium azide? That was the question that was asked of us. So we didn't have an assay for sodium azide, but we also had these patients that were in the ICU that needed immediate medical attention. And so we had to rush to try to put something together. We can give them some information to try to go on. Well, long story short, because I don't want to bore you with a lot of detail, there has been deaths related to sodium azide. We used that publication in developing our own assay within 24 hours of the plane crash. End result was, of the three patients that were in our ICU, we didn't see sodium azide. This was not the reason why they had trouble. And, you know, we're a little bit thankful for that because, you know, we have car accidents all the time and airbags do malfunction, and it doesn't appear that that's going to be a major source of toxicity. And for one person who was in the ICU for a long time, we never did find out what happened. We didn't know why she developed a delayed metabolic acidosis. Okay, next story. J.H. was a marginally successful pro golfer. He joins the senior PGA Tour in hopes of reviving his career and the accolades of being a pro golfer. Okay, so the stories are embellished. Okay, so there really was no pro golfer, but the rest of this is true, or at least some of it's true. After a round in a tournament, a woman finds him attractive and gives him his keys to her hotel, or to her hotel room. You know, so he's all excited, and I apologize for some of the younger kids in the room here, but, you know, these days they know more than we do anyway. He takes Herbal X, which is a herbal medication for ED, okay? I won't tell you what, I think you know what ED is. And in hopes of having excitement, he doubles his dose, thinking that it's natural. Herbal X is claimed to increase libido, has been, the ingredients are listed here, lots of natural ingredients, probably is very safe, right? You wouldn't think that that would cause any trouble. We got a hold of the pills to look at once something happened. We looked at these pills. They were from a nefarious location in China somewhere that when we did a Google search, you know, Google Maps search of the address, it was the middle of a lake. So clearly fictitious address. And we see this. And the end result of the medication that we looked at was that it was not a natural compound, that it was, in fact, a remnant, what we call designer drugs, of true ED medications, Vialis and Sildenafil. And you can see here that the chemical structures are similar to the real drug that requires FDA approval. What these people did is they manufactured the drug to make it a little bit different, sold it under the name of an herbal medication, and off you go. And so obviously it does work. What happened to the golfer? He dies of a heart attack during intercourse. Okay, so this is a story from another, from my next book here, entitled Tree Trunks Trudy. All right, so it's an overweight, hypothyroid woman who develops a deep vein thrombosis. So she's got a blood clot in her leg and undergoes magnetic resonance imaging angiography. And so when you do that, in order for the radiologist to really see what they're looking for is they inject a dye. And it used to be that they would add a radio-labeled dye, but these days they use gadolinium, okay? So the reason that she was called Tree Trunks Trudy is because she was overweight in school, and kids being the way they are, you know, that's what they used to call her. Just before the procedure, we do a test for a renal function, kidney function, called creatinine. Okay, if the creatinine is high, that means that there may be some pre-existing kidney dysfunction, and giving this dye may not be such a good idea. Okay, now because we have to do this quickly, we can't wait for the sample to come to the lab, and it takes us about an hour to get a result back. We offered this test sort of as a dipstick, what we call point of care device. It's just a little simple device. You put it in a machine and you get a result. But the good thing is that you can get a result in 5 minutes. And so while you're testing somebody, you can prep that person for the MRI, and you're not wasting valuable time trying to get a lab result back, okay? Because MRI time is literally thousands of dollars per minute. Unfortunately, in my story, a resident, a little bit overly ambitious, does the test, improper training, gets the wrong result. Gets a result that was normal when, in fact, it should have been higher. And what's the end result of this case? Well, so again, iodinated contrast media has been used for interventional radiology, but the question is gadolinium, which is one of these metals down here in the lanthanide series, is it thought to be safer? And the answer is that in the absence of renal disease, it is very safe. But in this case, the girl had a little bit of kidney dysfunction, and she develops this condition called gadolinium-induced nephrogenic systemic fibrosis. It's really kind of an autoimmune hardening. It's a toxic reaction to gadolinium, and what it's been described as your skin becomes really tight, really hard, and there comes our girl Tree Trunks Trudy. She develops nephrogenic systemic fibrosis. So what you don't know can kill you. Missing lights. Hispanic maid is sexually assaulted in a hotel while at a rock and roll musician. Decides to have the baby, delivers a premature baby. She's a little bit dark in pigmentation. And because of that, a transcutaneous bilirubin test is canceled. Now, bilirubin is an important analyte because if you're premature, you can't process this pigment that is formed from hemoglobin, and it can poison your brain. And so if you have this condition of hyperbilirubinemia, you need to be treated. And the best treatment is to put a child under ultraviolet light. And what that does is it helps break down the bilirubin and changes it into a form that can be excreted naturally. And it's all because some children are born prematurely. Now, we have this device. Sorry, I guess I didn't bring it. That where you can measure the bilirubin with just this device. You put it on the skin and it reads the color through the skin. You know, baby skin are very thin. But it doesn't really work very well for people of color, particularly Asians, because bilirubin is a little bit yellow, and so can Asian skin. And in this case, she was a little bit darker because she was Hispanic. Bottom line is that the test wasn't done. And what should have been done was a puncture, blood, sent to my lab and tested in the normal way. Well, that got overlooked, too, because they just assumed that the transcutaneous bilirubin was going to be done, and the regular bilirubin didn't get done, and the child got sent home and developed this condition known as kernicterus. Kernicterus leads to irreversible brain damage. You can see the concentrations here of when that can occur, and in this unfortunate story, the baby dies. What you don't know can kill you. Spice of this life, okay? So a 36-year-old female actress is preparing for a part. Her agent tries to relax her. She's a little bit uptight because she's auditioning for this role. And so the agent gives her these cookies that are laced with synthetic cannabinoids. She eats the cookies, becomes a little bit hallucinogenic and a little bit wild. And so she calls her husband on the cell phone and says, you know, you need to come home right away. I really don't feel well. I feel like I want to jump out the window. Okay, this is all a true story here. Husband rushes home, puts her in bed, and while he's in the bathroom, just for a minute, and they live on the third floor of an apartment building, she flies out the window. Now, she survives her fall. She's at the General for a week, but does eventually die of her internal injuries. Drug screen is done in my laboratory. It's negative for marijuana. So a synthetic cannabinoid is a compound that is structurally different from the naturally occurring marijuana that's found in weed. This is sold as spice. There's a number of different names. Actually, spice is no longer on the market because the FDA has removed it from the market, saying that it was dangerous. So instead, there are now second and third generation synthetic cannabinoids that are available. So it's difficult to keep track of what's out there. I send my fellows out there to buy stuff all the time, you know, and they're probably on some type of a DEA warning list. This is the history of synthetic cannabinoids. It was actually developed by a chemist at Clemson University who was attempting to try to find a compound that it mimics marijuana in the sense that it can relieve pain and nausea and could be very useful therapeutically for cancer patients and patients with pain without the hallucinogenic effects. So we have different cannabinoid receptors. One might stimulate the other at the expense of the second one. Unfortunately, what he ended up discovering was compounds that were more hallucinogenic than the actual compounds found in marijuana plants. And the chemists that are out there figured this out, started selling this, and this is what got this particular woman in trouble. Okay, the compounds are actually named after the scientist, JHW18, is John W. Huffman, compound number 18. These are the chemical structures of the classical cannabinoids on the left, and you can see they're very different from the ones that he synthesized, as well as the newer ones that are out there that are being abused today. So JWH-72 was identified in the blood of the woman who jumped out the window and died, and the agent who spiced her cookies with marijuana is currently up for involuntary manslaughter. Okay, next story. So this is a poster from Pop 2010, which is a rave, basically a disguised rave party that takes place every year at the Cow Palace. But in 2010, it was a little bit different. This one went deadly. So I'm going to give you a news broadcast of what happened that night less than 4 years ago.
Now to that huge rave at the Cow Palace that sent 11 people to the hospital. Tonight, five of them are still in critical condition, including one who's in a coma. We're also learning more tonight about the young man who died, reportedly from taking tainted drugs. KTVU's Amber Lee, live tonight at one hospital that is treating some of those patients. Amber?
Frank, we're at SF General, where 23-year-old Anthony Mata died and two others remain hospitalized here following Saturday night's rave. Tonight, Anthony's family told us they want those responsible prosecuted. Mata's aunt, Marie Arellano, clutched his high school graduation photo, telling us the family is in shock.
We love him and we miss him. More than anything, we just want him back.
Anthony lived here in Santa Clara with his aunt and grandmother. They told us he worked at a Toyota dealership in Milpitas as a technician and aspired to be a mechanic. They describe him as outgoing and say he loved his family above everything else.
Okay, so there were actually 11 patients who got sick. They were sent to different hospitals, including San Francisco General, as well as here, as well as Seton Medical Center. Three of them were at SFGH that were the most critically ill. And the question that came up, as you saw from the video, that Were these kids taking drugs that had been tainted with some adulterant that had caused this this effect? Because MDMA, ecstasy by itself, shouldn't have caused this rash of severe illnesses. And so we were called in to try to figure out what was in these pills. The police came, they were giving these pills away in an attempt to try to hook these kids onto the drug. And all throughout the weekend, they were asking us, okay, what is it, what is it? We had to sort of back off the reporters as well. Well, long story short, it turns out that none of those pills that we captured, the names are listed here, XZ and VT Light, were not contaminated with any adulterants. But what we did find was that the concentration were quite a bit higher than what was expected in usual pills. And so, for example, the bottom one, the one that the person died, the MDMA concentration was 270 milligrams, when a typical ecstasy dose that's sold in the black market is between 80 and 120. So this was almost 2.5 times or 3 times the normal dose. And if you give anything at excess concentrations, things that might have been safe at a regular concentration end up becoming quite dangerous. So this was a situation where there was somebody who was thinking that, well, if good is good, then more is better. Okay, here's my next case. This is one that came to the general. There was a chemist who works in a rug factory. This is important because when you're making rugs, you use these dyes that create the color. These are dyes that are made out of nitrogen compounds. He was playing soccer one day and collapsed on the field and is sent to the general. He's significantly cyanotic. So what that means is that he's not getting blood to his extremities. His fingernails are blue. His color is a little bit desaturated. And so we do a blood gas analysis. And what we can do is determine what is the degree that our oxygen is saturated, our hemoglobin is saturated with oxygen. And normally we like to be somewhere between 95 and 100%. This particular individual has a value of 74. So he has what we call a methemoglobinemia. The iron in his hemoglobin has oxidized from the +2 to the +3 state, and that makes it no longer capable of binding oxygen that we need in order to respire, in order for our tissues to work. So a toxicology analysis was done in my lab to determine, okay, why did he have this condition? Is it a genetic disease? And we ruled that out by doing some basic studies. Or was he exposed to some toxin that might have caused him to desaturate his hemoglobin? Now, we know that nitrites can do this. We looked for nitrites, it wasn't there. What did we find? This is the technique that we use to make these kinds of measurements. It's a machine called mass spectrometry. And what we found was this compound called aminonitrotoluene, okay? And it is a common aniline-type pigment that is used in making rugs. So that seemed pretty reasonable. Okay, he works in a rug factory. Maybe he's exposed to these kind of chemicals. Got a little bit of sloppy, wasn't wearing gloves, and there it goes. But the Poison Center sent an investigator to the house, to the company, because it became an occupational health issue. If he got sick by this, maybe other workers are getting exposed, and we need to do some type of analysis. And we come to find that, in fact, there is no manufacturing of rugs. It's just a warehouse that distributes them, that the colorants are made overseas. And so there was no occupational exposure. What's going on here? Well, we did some additional research. Does anybody know what the third compound on the left is, or the compound furthest on the left is? Okay, that's trinitrotoluene, also known as TNT. So the aminonitrotoluene is actually a breakdown product of TNT. So all kinds of bells and whistles got off then. Is this guy making a bomb? Should we contact Homeland Security? Should we be concerned that we have uncovered a terrorist in our own hospital? Okay, so none of this actually happened. We did find nitrotoluene, but we did not find TNT, and that's just part of my story. But I got all you guys, didn't I? Explosive blood. I hope you read that story. No snack for you. A 30-year-old moderately obese male with a history of infantile autism, pica. You know what pica is? This is when you put things in your mouth and you chew on it. Thank you. Is admitted to it lives in a home and dies a couple of days. He's admitted to a group home 2 days before his death. He is found unresponsive in a bathtub. At the time, he was before brought into the hospital, semi-conscious, has VTAC. The EMS were not able to obtain a pulse. They shocked him. He remained in asystole, and ultimately he dies within a couple of hours of presentation. On the day of his death, he had been let alone in an enclosed courtyard of the facility where he was suffering from pica, but just picking up things and eating them. Autopsy was done. They found two significant things. Number one, that there was a thrombi in his pulmonary artery, and the cause of death was listed as a pulmonary embolism. That happens. A blood clot breaks off in the leg, goes to the lungs, and this is a very serious medical condition. It's a natural cause of death. On the other hand, looking at the stomach contents, the pathologist saw greenish tan fluid, fragments of string bean, vegetable-like material, dark green plants, flat green flecks of vegetable-like material. Could this have anything to do with his death? Well, I got called in. By the way, so I'm in every one of these stories, but I'm not the hero. I'm not the guy who causes. Sometimes it's my lab that causes harm. Sometimes we're just the innocent bystander. So autopsy findings, they went to a botanist, and they said these are the things that were that the kid was eating. And of course, all these plants were available in that courtyard. Which of these plants is most toxic, or if any of these? Well, poinsettia is actually not toxic. That's actually more of a urban myth rumor. Actually, the Japanese yew is the most toxic. And so the medical examiner actually concluded that there was no pathologic evidence to suggest that that was the cause and ruled pulmonary embolism. But there were other pathologists who were hired to say, hey, you know, pulmonary embolism doesn't occur that often in a young guy. the clot didn't quite look right on gross microscopy. He might have been in some type of generalized state of hypercoagulability. This is the California Poison Control Center toxic rating for these plants. And actually, the rhododendron and the Japanese yew are amongst the most dangerous compounds. Poinsettias itself is only just very minor. And maybe you knew as a kid, you know, never eat the berries of a Japanese yew. Well, actually, the leaves are also very toxic. You can see the lethal dose there at the middle slide. And in fact, we take advantage of this. Taxol, which is a chemotherapeutic, was first derived from compound from Japanese yew. So this is the compound down there, but it's also responsible for cardiac toxicity. And it turns out, and I don't know who would have done this study, but chickens are really vulnerable. I should say horses are very vulnerable. They have the lowest LD50 in order to have toxicity, and we humans are somewhere in the middle. We can tolerate a little bit more, and actually chickens can eat all the Japanese yew that they want. And thank goodness for that, right? So we challenged this case that occurred in Rhode Island, the medical examiner's office, and cited this report. You know, the courts love to have previously published reports to go on. And if you have that, you can say, oh, see, our case mimics this. And this had already been described as a cause of death for unintentional plant poisonings from developmentally disabled adults, such as the case in our case. But unfortunately, this was one of the ones where we lost. The verdict of the civil case, facility found not guilty. But they did remove all of the toxic plants from the area, and the garden is a lot safer now than it was. So we did accomplish something. Hospital daycare, okay? So there's a condition known as Munchausen syndrome. It's a condition where someone causes harm to themselves in order that for them to get medical attention. Or it's just a psychiatric disease to say, you know, look at me, I need help. Now, there is another condition known as Munchausen syndrome by proxy. And that's when a parent causes harm to an unsuspecting or a child who is totally innocent by falsifying records and doing bad things so that they could be given hospitalized care. They're not trying to kill them. They're just trying to get them out of the house by poisoning them. So there was a case. This was not my case, but a case that was published, well known in the literature, where a child was taken away from a mother because of what appeared to be poisoning by ethylene glycol. Ethylene glycol is a toxic alcohol. This mother was poisoning the child, but not to the point where the child was killed. In this case, the Missouri Division of Family Services took custody of the child, and during a supervised visit, the mother fed the baby a bottle, and the child immediately became lethargic, muscle spasms, and they did an investigation of the bottle, and they found ethylene glycol, and they suspected that she was poisoning him. So she was put in jail, and the child was put into foster care. But then, weeks later, the woman while I was in prison had conjugal visits by her husband, and she gets pregnant and has another child while in prison. This is all true story. And what happened was that the child, the second child, exhibited the exact same symptoms as the first child, except that now the mother wasn't around the poisoner. So maybe the child wasn't poisoned in the first place. And maybe the mother didn't have Munchausen syndrome by proxy. So the original samples were sent to a lab. This is the original chromatograms. EG stands for ethylene glycol. What we're looking for are peaks. And these peaks have to line up. And the standard for ethylene glycol did not line up for the standard of propionic acid. In fact, it was later determined that this child and the sister had a metabolic inborn error of metabolism, and that's why she caused. That's why the patient continuously got sick, and it was not linked to the mother. And so the mother was exonerated; she was sent home from prison. Now, the reason I bring this case up is because we had a very similar case. We had a mother who was bringing in a child on repeated visits for the very same symptoms. And we thought, okay, let's just be 100% sure that this is not a inborn error metabolism. We have better techniques than we had back in 1992. And we did the testing, and we found in this case that it was methanol poisoning, similar to what you see with ethylene glycol poisoning. But was this a true positive, or was this another false positive, and perhaps we were incriminating the wrong person again? So this is the mass spec data that confirms the retention times. We were pretty confident. We also had other avenues that suggested that this was, in fact, true methanol poisoning. This is the toxicologist at the time who was helping me with this case. And the important thing that we wanted to make sure was that we wanted to not be incarcerated ourselves. The story actually goes a lot deeper. She ended up, she was taking a class, so this is true Munchausen syndrome by proxy. She was taking a toxicology class and learning about toxic alcohols. And then 3 weeks later, she was poisoning her own kid.
Like this class here.
What's that?
Like this class here.
Well, I hope none of you are getting ideas. Next story is called Fatal Dedication. So this is the story of this woman by the name of Lisa. She gave all of her money to this Church of Scientology. And so I'm going to show you a video. This was highlighted on one of the TV programs.
That pressure. On the night of November 18, 1995, it appears that the pressure may have become too much. Lisa was taken to a Clearwater hospital after a minor traffic accident.
Why was she taken to the hospital?
She was taken to the hospital by paramedics who came to the scene, and she was taken because she had taken her clothes off and was walking down the street.
According to hospital records we obtained from her family, Lisa told EMS workers at the scene she needed to talk and that she took her clothes off to make people think she was crazy.
Okay, so this is a story where this woman who had given her life savings to join this church and now was having second thoughts and was thinking, gee, you know, maybe I made a mistake, maybe I want to get out. And so she tried to get out and at the same time became sick. And she was in the care of the facility and was taken to a hospital, bypassing another hospital that was closer because the ED doctors there were not members of the church. A little bit suspicious, okay? She ends up dying in the facility. Autopsy was conducted, and these are the findings. So the principal finding was that there was a hematoma on the left thigh and that there was another pulmonary embolus that was found in the pulmonary artery, that, again, died of natural causes of a pulmonary emboli. This is the autopsy photo. It's not too bad, of her leg with the bruise. Now, this would have been fine. Nobody would have ever thought of anything else except that this was a high-profile case. This was a woman who was trying to leave the Church of Scientology. And the autopsy lab data had one very unusual abnormality, and it's listed in red here. She had a blood urea nitrogen content, actually a vitreous humor urea nitrogen content that was 15 times abnormal. And now normally when we see that in blood, we think of things like dehydration or perhaps renal disease or perhaps something called prerenal azotemia that sometimes can be caused by heart failure. They were saying, aha, the church killed the woman by starving her, depriving her of fluids, and there's the evidence. Well, so I was brought in to actually defend the Church of Scientology. Okay, I'm not a Scientologist, you know, and I don't necessarily believe in what they believe in, but I do believe in scientific truth, wherever side it might fall. And I believe that the other side was trying to damage the reputation unnecessarily and damaging this particular woman's history. It was all over the internet, all over the news. It was quite horrendous for the family, as you can imagine. So there is no published connection between dehydration and pulmonary emboli. So she didn't. They knew that she had an emboli, but was it because they were not giving her water? And the answer is, you can dehydrate yourself all you want, and there's no evidence that should happen. And in fact, we looked at literature studies to see that can urea nitrogen be increased with storage, with instability, with breakdown of proteins to produce this metabolite? And the answer is, at least in some studies, the answer in canines, the answer is yes, that you could see that. And the testing was done many years after the autopsy, so there was a lot of question about the validity of the laboratory tests. We know as a laboratory scientist that the results are only as good as the specimen that we have. And there were other experts' opinions. You might know this guy, Michael Bodden, who was a forensic pathologist in New York City, who said, no, I think that this was an accidental cause of death. So did a number of different studies to try to determine that it was, in fact, a contaminant, perhaps, or perhaps it was, again, a breakdown product. And in the end, the trial ended up exonerating the church. Now, there's a little bit of a sidebar that I didn't show. The medical examiner at the time had been sort of cheated out of property that the church bought in her house or in her neighborhood and devalued. And so she ended up being accused of having some type of personal vendetta against the church. And as a result of this highly profiled case, the governor of Florida, which was at that time Jeb Bush, actually forced her resignation as a result of this case because she kind of went overboard in making these outlandish conclusions that were not validated by scientific fact.
What actually killed her? What was
the pulmonary emboli.
Okay, but no explanation for that other than natural death.
Well, so she, in that video, she was in a traffic accident. She takes off her clothes, is running naked, and that bruise on her thigh was the blood clot. And then that lodged, went up to the lungs, and she died. That's our best explanation. That's the most obvious explanation. Dr. Singh mentioned something about pharmacogenomics. Pharmacogenomics is a new science where we do genetic analysis to try to determine genetic predisposition against adverse events with therapeutics. And so here's a situation where there was this woman who was developed atrial fibrillation and was put on warfarin. When she questions the doctor about the appropriateness of the dose, the doctor says, you know, trust me. Turns out that medical mistakes is the third leading cause of death in the U.S., behind cancer and cardiovascular disease. And most of these are related to medications. This is a situation where we have a dangerous medication that can cause harm in a minority of patients, and that we now have the tools to be able to identify those who are going to be at greatest risk. And this is what pharmacogenomics is all about. And what it means is that some of us are slow metabolizers, and some of us are fast metabolizers. So if you look at this drug, imipramine, which is an antidepressant drug, if you are in the red bar and you are a slow metabolizer, you need about a third less dose in order for it to be effective than somebody who's normal or somebody who we call wild type. And then if you are in the yellow and you are a hypermetabolizer, then you need more drug because it's breaking down too fast. It's the people that are slow metabolizers that we worry the most, because the normal dose that's given to somebody who is a slow metabolizer can, in fact, be toxic. So in the story of a fib about a fib, I'm going to cut to the chase here, the woman has a hemorrhagic stroke because the 5 milligram dose that's typically given was an overdose for her. And in the end, the doctor had a fib about a fib. Sorry, a little play on words. So it's still very controversial. The testing has not been uniformly adopted, but ideally it's you should be tested at the time that you're first put on the dose. Because if you're on warfarin, you should have regular INR testing and dosages adjusted accordingly. So the pharmacogenomic test does not supersede the need to do INR testing, PT-INR.
What is the test?
It's a genetic test to look at genes that affect the metabolism and the pharmacodynamics of the drug.
And other drugs?
The other drugs are also involved, yes. Very much so. Yeah.
I'm on warfarin. I took it. I was tested every 2 days for about a week or so. And then I'm now on a stable, and I'm tested every 6 weeks.
What is your dosage?
I take 5 milligram one day and 2.5 milligram the next.
Okay, so that's a little bit on the low side, but somewhat typical. My mother's on warfarin, and she requires 1.5 milligrams to maintain a stable INR. If she had been given 5 milligrams from the get-go, she might not be here today. Okay, this is my last case. It's called the fake. I'm sorry, you first.
Yeah, I mean, prospectively, let's say you're going to be put on a MIP, whatever. Is there a way to actually do a test to see if you're a slower metabolite before you take the drug?
Yes. Yes, but it hasn't been universally adopted yet at UCSF or any other place, quite frankly.
Do you think that the warfarin business will soon be turned over and you have drugs instead of...
So, for those of you didn't hear, when are we going to get rid of warfarin? And the answer is that we actually are already in that process. There are now other oral anticoagulants that can be given that don't require... are a little bit safer and don't have this pharmacogenomic implication, but they are still on patent and they're quite a bit more expensive. My advice, many of you may be on warfarin. If you're stable and you do regular PT-INRs, you're fine. It's really the people who just get started. The original dose, so let me go back here. I think I hit a nerve here. More than 7% of outpatients suffer a major hemorrhagic event within the first month of being put on warfarin. And that's because it's sometimes difficult to titrate the best dose to maintain a stable INR. So this is a case report. Over here is the INR values. You want to be between 2 and 3. This person had values at least up to 5, which could be toxic to that person. Dosages were adjusted, which was the bottom figure, and then boom, it went too low. And now that patient's subject to thrombosis. So this trial and error stuff is really kind of nonsense. We should be doing a better job on that. Yeah.
What is INR?
I'm sorry. So INR stands for the International Normalized Ratio. It is the degree of anticoagulation. So you're on a blood thinner because you've had a stroke or you've had a heart attack. We want to prevent another stroke or heart attack from happening. Strokes are caused by blood clots. So by thinning out the blood, it increases the time it takes for your blood to coagulate. So in the lab, what we do is we take your blood, we add a chemical, and we count the seconds it takes for your blood to clot. If you're on warfarin, the number of seconds increases by twofold, by threefold. And that's the objective, is to prevent clotting. Now, that means that if you get hurt, you cut your finger, you get bruised easily, that's the downside of being on blood thinners. Or more dramatically, you can have a cerebral head bleed. Yeah.
When you have surgery, like a knee replacement or something, and they give you warfarin, you know, for the first 2 weeks or something, do they test you to see if you can tolerate it, or is that just coming on in a lab test of your metabolism? Or?
Yeah, so this is still very controversial. We're not to the point where we routinely do warfarin testing. Plus, it's expensive. Plus, it takes a little bit extra effort. But what they do is this INR testing. So that is something that will continue to happen. You need to have your blood tested regularly for INR and your dose adjusted accordingly.
Even though you're on other medication.
So if you change your medication, then even more so, you need to be routinely monitored because that can affect the levels of your drug. Certain drugs inhibit the metabolism of your other drugs potentiate that metabolism. So, and even just eating a different diet, having more green vegetables can affect your INR.
Because out on TV, there's a guy taking another medication instead of warfarin, and it sounds like the bee's knees, you know? Is it the bee's knees? And he said, no, you don't need testing anymore.
Yeah, so some of these next-generation oral anticoagulants, which have only been around for the last couple years, dabigatran is one of them, a lot of these problems should go away. But it is also quite a bit more expensive. Yeah.
Sorry. I eat a lot of green vegetables. Is that I should not be worried, right?
Well, you're not on a blood thinner, right?
No.
You have nothing to worry about. Okay, my last case. This is called The Vacationing Rapist. So let me start with a video.
The headlines called him the preppy fugitive. After 8 years on the run, Alex Kelly had come home. He still seemed just an all-American teenager, a wealthy kid, championship wrestler, an honors student who flashed a smile and in an interview with Turning Point denied the charge was true.
I believe the system's going to work, and I'm back here to fight for the truth.
But a number of women say the truth is that Alex Kelly is a rapist.
Okay, so this is the chronology. He was in high school. He was a big-time college or high school wrestler. He offers a ride to a girl he's never met before and rapes her in the back of a Jeep. This is in 1986. He's indicted. He's arraigned. And instead, he flees from the jurisdiction. He ends up in Europe, where he spends the next 8 years in Switzerland, supported by his family. That's his parents in Switzerland. But finally, the cops figure out that the family is supporting them. They've been bugging their telephone lines and mail, and they find him, they extradite him, and he stands trial. There were actually two trials that were heard in Stamford, Connecticut. One of them ended up in a hung jury. This is the first trial where the defense is trying to argue that the rape victim was high on drugs at the time of the rape. And the basis for that argument was that they retrieved blood spots from the Jeep where she was raped, which was virginal intercourse, and 10 years later, they find traces of marijuana. The data didn't hold up to scientific scrutiny. There wasn't the usual mass spec confirmation procedure, and so we tried to argue that the data should not be admissible to court. Unfortunately, it was admitted, and it ended up resulting in a hung jury. 2 years later, the district attorney decides to retry the case, but this time the defense finds additional evidence that wasn't tested 2 years prior. This time they had the victim's undergarments, which was also bloody, and they also examined it for drugs, also finding marijuana. But this time they do the mass spec analysis that's useful for confirming the result. So it was more defensible in a court of law. So this is the data for a standard for marijuana, and this is the actual data that they presented in court. So I might mention that the defense attorney was the same guy who got Klaus von Bülow off for the murder trial he had poisoned his wife, and she was in a coma for many years. So a little bit nefarious. To a toxicologist, this is a nice chromatogram. This is a mess. And what we did was we took analytic noise, and we underwent the same type of digital smoothing, the so-called Svitsky-Golay. It's a computer program that just smooths out peaks. Okay, so we took white noise, subjected it to the same degree of digital smoothing, and we get the same thing. So this was fabricated data. This did not hold up in court, and as a result, the case did go to verdict.
Is short-lived. Alex Kelly's retrial goes in the other direction. This time, jurors are unanimous that they did rape a 16-year-old Catholic schoolgirl on that night of February 10th in 1985. In sentencing, the judge throws the book at him. 20 years
see
in
the
prison,
girl.
With eligibility
now
for parole
years old.
Only after 16 years. 10 years of probation following his release, a $10,000 fine, and 200 hours of community service to be done at a rape crisis center once he is finally out of jail.
I am grateful that Judge Tierney has finally sentenced Alex Kelly appropriately for what he did to me so long ago, and I hope that this sends a message out to other rape victims around the country. And that's all I have to say.
Charges on.
So when he was found guilty, he still denies it. His comment was, "Are you serious? I'm not guilty. I'm not guilty. I did not do this. Why are you doing this to me? So he was given 20 years, a 16-year sentence. Unfortunately, he was paroled in 2007. He's now on the street, but he has a ankle bracelet. And there was a movie made, The Return of Alex Kelly. Do any of you ever watch the show Quincy? So there's an actor there, the lab guy by the name of Robert Edo. He played the part of me in the movie. Now, you got to remember now, these are fabricated. This was a true story, but this is a fabrication. I was not in the movie. We're past our time. I actually have one other case. It's just one slide. If it's okay, I can show it to you, if you have to leave, okay? these are the stories that I've told you, again, true. I fictionalized the characters to make them a little bit more interesting and more true to life, because I don't know the inner thoughts of these people that were undergoing these things while they were alive or when they were doing the things that they were doing. But I'm also a science fiction guy, and so I always like this concept of what if. What if something happened that could have changed the course of history? And in my world, the what if is that you have a laboratory test that allows you to diagnose something at the time in history when it really wasn't available. You know, it's sort of like going back in the time and fixing something, telling Abraham Lincoln you're going to get shot, and then the world changes from then on because he didn't go to Ford Theater. Well, imagine this. This movie called, story called Bladder Control. Okay, so Hubert Humphrey had undiagnosed bladder cancer when he ran for presidency in 1968, and many of you, you know, remember old enough around then. 25 years later, years after he died, scientists at Johns Hopkins retrieved biopsies from Mr. Humphrey that were still in their files and re-examined his case, looking now for a genetic test called P53 that back in 1968 didn't exist, but now 25 years later, they knew that they had evidence that, in fact, he had bladder cancer at the time that he was running for president, okay? So in history, Humphrey did not distance himself from Johnson's anti-war policy until the last few weeks of the election because he knew he was going to lose. And that changed everything. It changed him from being really far behind in the polls to one where he almost won the election. And in fact, had he changed his policy and distanced himself from Johnson, he might have won the election. Okay, history shows that a change in just 153,000 votes out of the 73 million cast in the key four states listed there would have been enough for him to win the election. And so my story says, okay, so what if we had the technology? He knew he had bladder cancer at the time of the 1968 Democratic Convention. It's too late to find another candidate. He throws all caution to the wind and says, okay, I'm going to go by my heart. He really was a pacifist. He believed that the war was wrong. He changed his tune two or three weeks before before he actually did in history and wins the election. Everything changes, right? Humphrey's president, not Nixon. And then the story goes on, what if? All right, one more. It's not in the book, you can't buy it yet. This is called Purple Rain. So King George III of England ruled during the Revolutionary War. Centuries later, medical historians suggested that he had a disease called porphyria. Now, porphyria is a genetic disease that causes you to have skin lesions, causes you to have photosensitivity. You can hallucinate. You can have neurologic disease. You can have lots of bad things that happen just because you're exposed to sunlight. Now, during the time when the colonists wanted equal representation, you know, no taxation without representation, they didn't really want war. They just wanted somebody in Parliament to say, you know, this is not fair to the colonists. The king, against his political advisors, because the advisors didn't want war either, he goes, damn them, you know, it's my way or the highway. If I let the Americans go, then, you know, next is going to be Canada, and next will be India and all these other places. No, I'm holding steady. We're going to have this war. What if lab tests that are available now were available in the 1700s when he lived? He was treated for porphyria, fluids, avoids the sunlight, altered his personality. He no longer became so belligerent, became a kinder king, settles with the colonists. There is no Revolutionary War. How would the U.S. be different if we were still a colony? That's really the tenor of the story. Okay. All right. We wouldn't be talking Obamacare. We'd have already had it. All right, so I'm going to give away this book. Where's the other one? Anybody have the other one? Okay, so give me a number from 1 to 26.
13.
13. Okay, so give me a number from 1 to 26.
18.
Okay, so 13 is which letter of the alphabet? Okay, M. So the winner is Kathy Manchel. Is she here? Okay. And then 18, did you say?
I should pick a better number. This is 18. No, I said it out loud.
Okay, so M-N-O-P-Q-R. Somebody with an R's last name is Suzanne Rich. Suzanne? All right. So thank you very much. We have the room for questions.
Yeah, until 8:30.
I'm here.
In our daily lives, we are around products and eat probably produce and, you know, vegetables and fruits that are sprayed upon, or products that emit some kind of toxic gases or fumes or what have you. How can a consumer or a lay person go about figuring out what's in their blood, or is there any kind of toxicity within the blood?
Well, certainly I wouldn't go on a witch hunt just because you're eating a product and you're suspecting something. We would need to be able to link. Okay, I'm sorry. So the question is that if you're exposed to something and you're not sure about the contents and it may in fact be toxic, is there something you can do and what would you do? And my advice is to first get off that compound and see if that makes a difference, and see if you have independent evidence that in fact what you're consuming or being exposed to is the culprit. This is very difficult to do, but that is one thing to do. And then if you were to somehow be re-exposed by whatever reason and those symptoms appear, then it would be time to talk to an occupational toxicologist. And we have such a program here at UCSF, and these people are expert, and I work with them directly, and we can look at blood levels, but it's really a needle in the haystack.
I mean, more around the lines of, you were talking about the carpet factory. You buy a rug and it, you know, has some kind of chemical. How do you?
So the question is, like in my story, explosive blood, where the person was exposed to dyes that were found in the rug. Anytime that you buy a new product that has some type of smell, it could be a shower curtain, it could be a lot of different things, and you feel like there's sensitivity of your body to it, I would recommend that just leave it outside for a while, let it be exposed to the sun. The sun is a natural healer that will oxidize these chemicals, and you're probably going to be fine. But you're right, you know, OSHA is way behind in trying to mandate toxic substances. We have a research program where we are looking at the effects of household chemicals and the effect on man. And one of our targets is bisphenol A. Bisphenol A can produce a feminization because it is a steroid, a estrogen-like steroid. Doesn't affect children or adults, but it does affect our newborn children. And so we're trying to get that banned. Yeah. Bisphenol A. So that's, you know, everything you drink, bisphenol A. It's even in your, I don't have one, your receipts. If you have a thermal receipt, you know, and you go like this, you're being exposed to bisphenol A.
Like the new car smell?
It's not, so the question is it smell? And the answer is no. You can't smell it. Yes.
We hear about BPA-free water bottles and things like that.
Yeah, so yes, so the BPA water bottles are available. I highly recommend, especially if you are pregnancy years. You know, again, adults, not a problem, but if you want to have children, you need to stay away from that as much as you can. It's nearly impossible because it's everywhere. Yes?
Is there a relationship between, in terms of metabolism, between sheer weight and metabolism, or are they independent of each other? So if someone gains a lot of weight or loses a lot of weight, and they're on Coumadin, for example, is the metabolism related to the weight gain or loss?
So the question is metabolism related to weight gain or loss? Weight does play a minor effect on metabolic rate and blood concentrations. So if you're a big, heavy person, the same dose as somebody who is half that size would be much higher in that smaller person. But in terms of the therapeutic effect, and the therapeutic effect is going to be dependent on how much is in the blood. So the answer is yes, there is an effect of weight. Yes?
Well, back to the two, three drugs that are now being introduced as a substitute for warfarin, what is being done with them, apart from the price, what is being done with them that makes them more effective? Why do you, for instance, not have to have an evaluation from, let's say, a blood test every month or so?
So the question is, these alternate warfarin-like drugs, oral anticoagulants, how are they able to avoid the need for INR testing? They operate on a different principle of coagulation. Coagulation is a very complex multi-step process which can be inhibited in many different stages of that process. And what clever pharmacologists have found is that we can inhibit a different cycle of that stage and the effects are going to be different. Yeah?
There's been quite a bit of publicity recently about the difference in dosages of drugs to men and women, with most testing having been done on men. What you were talking about is a pharmacogenics testing. Address that particular area?
So the question is that are there differences in how men react to certain drugs versus women? And the answer is yes for some, no for others. It really depends. We can't really categorize them. In terms of our testing, we do try to characterize gender. And you are correct. The statement was that most of the drugs, when they were approved, were done on men. And the applicability of the dose for women is in question. That is absolutely true. Yeah, in the back.
You were mentioning about BPA, getting back to BPA, that it's not harmful for adults and children, because there's all these reports of BPA, do BPA-free water bottles and avoid those sorts of receipts.
Yeah, so the question is, I had made a comment that BPA is not really that toxic to adults or children. What I really meant to say is that it is less toxic. It is certainly more toxic for the newborn, which is where our studies are focusing. But to say that it's completely free of toxicity is false. Now, we are also doing something called toxicogenomics, where we're looking at genetic variances that predisposes even adults to the harmful effects of BPA. So what BPA does is it gets metabolized to a non-toxic compound that can be readily excreted. It's called a glucuronide. If you have a genetic defect where you cannot produce that glucuronide, then the parent compound sticks around longer. We think that's going to be a problem. Yep.
So what's the one thing that you stay away from that the rest of us probably are like, oh, yeah, we do that all the time?
So the question is, what do I stay away from? I can't really answer that. I don't really know. I'm not a good patient. I'm the kind of guy that can eat anything and can do anything. But certainly the organic foods is real. I think that those things should be adhered to as much as possible if you can afford the extra cost. Yeah.
What's a beta blocker? What does that mean?
A beta blocker is used to. So the question is, what is a beta blocker? It's a drug that's used to control rhythm, to control heart rate. And if we can control that in a patient who has had a cardiac event, then they're less likely to have a cardiac event. So I might mention something about beta blockers because Malini said that we're missing the Olympics. So there's an event in the Olympics called the Nordic Combined where you do long distance cross country and then you stop and you shoot a gun. Beta blockers are abused in those athletes because what they do is they, you know, you're breathing heavy and you're trying to control, trying to steady yourself and your heart's going boom, 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 boom. You take a beta blocker, it slows it down, and now you can shoot without having to do that. And so they actually test in the Olympics abuse of beta blockers amongst those athletes. Yeah?
Do you test any natural substances for toxins, or is all your work done on synthetics?
We do both. So the question is, do we test natural substances? So this Herbal X drug that that my golfer was doing, that was a product. It was not a blood sample that we tested. It was actually the product. So the answer is yes, we do. Yeah?
That sounded like an herbal substance that the person bought at a drugstore, at a rainbow store or something like that. So I thought that if I buy herbal substances, that they're approved by the FDA and it's okay for me to take them.
No,
that's not true.
So the question is, if you buy an herbal medication over the counter, are you getting what you think you're getting, and is it FDA approved? And the answer is absolutely no. The FDA does not regulate herbal medications. They're actually called nutraceuticals, and it's a food product, and they're not subject to regulation. Now, in Europe, they are. So it's a little bit of a problem for the FDA because if you file a complaint, if you say, oh, I took this and I got this problem, they will do an investigation, and they have the power to pull the drug or the product from the shelves. But as I indicated in my story, what happens is these fly-by-night operations, they just change their location, put a different label on the medication, and within 2 weeks, they're back in sale again. You can't control it. Yeah?
Is there a good place or website to check for things? Like I'm always hearing things about these mushroom things. You're supposed to take these mushroom capsules or something. And something else called Trifala. But they're all supposedly a natural plant products. And
So the question is there a website or is there a database that we can go to check up on a particular product to see if it's safe? And the answer is no. You know, probably the best thing you do is Google it to see if anybody has complained about it, but there's nothing scientific, no. Sorry to say. Yeah.
And then it's sort of true that there's a lot of doctors out there that we all go to. And some of them are pretty good at knowing about these things. I mean, they're good at knowing about prescriptive medicines, but on these non-prescriptive things,
So the question is, we have doctors who know pharmacology and who know FDA-approved products, but they're less knowledgeable about herbal medications, and that's absolutely correct. And so I would really use caution in relying on an alternative medication without really doing some investigation. I mean, I'm not saying that they're all bad. Many of them are, in fact, very good, but they're not all that good. Some of them can be very bad.
And I just want to echo Dr. Wu's comment about that, to reiterate that it's true. Also, since it's not FDA regulated, they haven't done studies on interactions with other medications. So you might be on prescription medications for certain medical diagnoses, and if you can take an herbal medication, there's really not a lot of data or science that's proof to show there's any bad interactions with what you're on. And that's generally our concern.
In the pharmacogenomics, if someone's a slow metabolizer, that's just across the board with any medication?
No.
So that can vary?
So the question is, if you're a slow metabolizer, is that across the board? The answer is that there are a family of isoenzymes in the liver, and each one is responsible for one or more of the drugs. So there's something called 2D6, 2C9, 2C19, 3A4, 3A5, and you could be a hypermetabolizer in one drug, and a poor metabolizer in another, and there's just no way to predict. Only way to do it.
Test to see if you're a slow metabolizer or fast metabolizer.
So the question is there just one test? Actually, there is one test, and it's called 23andMe. So you can get your entire genome genotyped.
I've done that.
Okay, and then they'll tell you which genes you're hyper or hypo or normal, but then you have to sort of have the wherewithal to interpret that data. And that's the reason that the FDA is kind of putting a lot of scrutiny to them. They're saying that, you know, you can't just give people genotypes without some information of what they mean. And a lot of them, we don't know what they mean. And without a pharmacologist or a doctor to interpret that result, it could be actually more harm than good. In fact, that's a couple of my stories to talk about that. Anybody else? Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.